is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Simon Foster, I'm just going to assume that you're well. We're going to just add it to the minutes as taken. But first,
yes.
Simon, are you excited that Nicolas Cage is back on the big screen? Because how often does that happen?
Well, I know. You barely see him on the big screen. It's very exciting. How are all the screen watchers out there? And I'm glad to be back. We had a good break. I've managed to get myself burnt. Terribly, terribly burnt. As Dan can attest to, I just prior to recording this, I was peeling layers of skin off my scarred body. That made for good would make for good podcasting, but we're not doing that. The other thing that's really going to sicken us over the next few days is the Golden Globes are dropping. Variety put a piece out this morning that, and I quote, "The Hollywood Foreign Press is embracing a new network in CBS, an untested host in Joe Coy," who I don't know who that is, "and an expanded 300 voting members worldwide." So could this be the most surprising Golden Globes telecast in history? You are a general naysayer of all things Globish. It's kind of a guilty pleasure for me, but only because I like seeing millionaires in expensive clothes pat themselves on the back. Dan, are you changed your tone at all with the Globes going forward?
Okay, so, boy, there's like so many points I need to get through here. First of all, I find it adorable that you think that anyone cares about your sunburn and that your Brundle Fly experience now is of interest and not disgusting our listenership / viewership. Put that in the minutes. The other thing, Golden Globes, you put there on a rundown that I'm looking at here, and let me just get the phrasing of the question. Could this be the most surprising in history? Is that your question or is that the question that Variety were asking?
No, Variety put that forward in a piece overnight record this.
Yep. Okay, so the reason why they're suggesting it could be the most surprising ever, because that encouraged you to want to watch it. Wait a second, who owns the Variety publication? Who owns the Golden Globes? Wait, is it the same Penske Media? Have they got a vested interest to try to get people excited about the Golden Globes? I think there might be a bit of a correlation there, Simon. Here's the thing. The Golden Globes have always been a horrendously corrupt and just terrible organization that have no credibility, and the value that film critics or any sort of culture watcher may have in watching it, I've never understood it. These people know better to actually have any sort of minor just investment in the Golden Globes,
because they're trash and always have been.
The thing is,
Let me finish my sentence.
They've swept out that element of corruption from it, so it's a bit more legitimate in terms of the voting body. But then you've got the other layer of this, which is that it's owned by the same company that owns every Hollywood publication coming in, like reporting on the industry. Basically, there's this massive engine that's feeding the Golden Globes, and it's all just a bit gross. I mean, the awards themselves might be slightly more legitimate, but also you just have to think about, why do stars in Hollywood feel as though this is something that's worthy of their time? The reason it's worthy of their time is because all the reporting that happens about Hollywood, good and bad, is from the same people that are handing out these awards. Like, Hollywood is being blackmailed into partaking in these awards. And I kind of just think it's a bit gross anyone outside of Penske Media really talking up these awards, because it's just horrendously just corrupt is really the only phrase you can use.
But hasn't the machine always controlled the award season roster? The Oscars came about because the studios wanted to up the promotion of their movies and try to have some sort of award season that promoted the films.
No, Simon. That is the words, I guess, whitewashing. That's not really quite what this is. The awards were set up not just as a promotional vehicle. That's the message that Holly wants you thinking about these days. The reason the awards were originally set up is because, and I think this is one of your quiz questions later on, the reason why the awards were originally established was purely to, like, keep the unions in check. Well, actually, to stop the town from unionizing. Okay, they figured that by providing some awards and getting everyone excited about their industry, they might be less likely to form unions and go on strike. That was the original intent of the awards. Okay, the positive bow they put on it is, oh, we'd like to promote some movies. Added benefit, that's not why the awards originally were created. But
to
anyway,
my point, though, it's always the machine. But to my point, it is always the machine controlling this award season roster. It's always some aspect that is self-serving. So should it be that much of a surprise that Penske Media have taken this overriding control of the Golden Globes and are trying to, in their own way, make it better?
If the Golden Globes were controlled by Penske Media, who Penske Media also controlled, say, one Hollywood publication, okay, I'd have less of an issue with that. But they control all of them. They control the Hollywood Reporter. They control Deadline. They control Variety. They control publications like Rolling Stone and a wealth of other big marquee publication titles. Okay, there's it's just this one company running it all. There's actually no way to really escape from it. And you can't take a stand against these awards because you'll just be blacklisted by everybody. Like, it's just
really gross. Does that impinge really upon the integrity of the award themselves?
Yes.
In the giving out of the awards, the voting of the awards.
If the foundation of the awards is corrupt, then everything that stands upon that is also just equally as corrupt.
Wow. That's a big call. We are coming out all guns blazing in 2024, Dan Barrett. That's going to go viral. I think there's a viral sort of attitude there that's going to rock the foundation of the Hollywood elite.
Yeah, okay. Look, I feel I'm not the only person that's really talking about this, so I can't really say this viewpoint's going to go viral ahead of everyone also saying it. The only places you're not seeing this commentary is the Penske Media. So, you know, no. I think good media literacy is reading outside of those major mastheads.
Let's get on with the reviews. We've got plenty to talk about in 2024. Let's start with this first review segment of the year.
It stinks.
Hitting Netflix this weekend is The Brother's Son, a black comedy action television series created by Brad Falchuk and Brian Wu. Let's play a clip. We'll come back on the other side.
The family is under attack. Some new gang wants to take our place. It's time for my brother to step up.
I don't want to be a gangster.
What if I just want to do what I want?
We have a word for that in Taiwan. American.
Okay, Simon, here's what you need to know about this program. A couple of weeks ago on this show, we were talking about, gosh, I can't even think of the name of the program now. It had a fairly unremarkable title. It was that show that was from the Cobra Kai guys about the bomb in Las Vegas. You really liked the show. I thought it was Hot Trash.
Yep. Obliterated. Oh, I think it's Hot Trash.
Okay, so Obliterated. Yeah. You loved it, though. Okay, so Obliterated was a very sort of trashy comedy that appealed heavily to fairly simple-minded 12-year-old boys. And Simon Foster. Correlation, you know, there we are.
Make of that what you will.
So, look, make of that what you will. Within a couple of weeks, I find it interesting that they have another action-adventure show, which is almost geared towards a similar audience. The difference is while that took its cues very much from 1980s Americana, Hollywood blockbuster cinema. And when I say blockbuster cinema, I mean more those films that you found on VHS in 1988 that had that same voiceover man giving all the trailer narration for it. Like, it was just that sort of product of cheap actioners that we saw come through. And that was the inspiration for that. This one is maybe more sort of based around sort of 80s through 90s Jackie Chan movies. Is probably the best point of comparison and probably a style of action comedy that was picked up by like those late 90s, early 2000s, Mark Wahlberg films, like The Big Hits, one that really came to mind as I was thinking about that. But the point of reference here, very much. So my point of reference here is probably more the Jackie Chan films, but certainly there's a lineage that follows that. And we haven't seen films or TV shows like that really much since like the mid-2000s. It seems to be a type of genre that is more or less sort of faded away. I mean, I'm sure if you're really into the genre, you'd probably have a few examples you'd throw at me. But I just remember I remember the feeling I had watching the first episode of this, which was I haven't seen this kind of thing on my screen in some time. And maybe it's because I got mature and just stopped paying attention to this kind of thing. But here we are. Premise of this one is we open up in Taipei. There's a guy who's in his kitchen. It's late at night. He's watching the Great British Bake Off. He's baking a cake. And then suddenly he hears something sort of happening out in his hallway, goes for a bit of a looky-loo. Suddenly three or four guys, I don't know, come busting in with guns and knives, and this guy is ready for it. He just immediately springs to action, and you have a very intense fight scene, which is just freaking exciting. It is a really cool opening to this TV show, and within the first, it's like a 2-minute long fight sequence, and there's no shaky camera. Like, you can really see the martial arts prowess on display throughout this fight sequence. It's really fun and it's great. And there's one final kill that happens off camera in the best possible way. A lot of fun. Anyway, as you realize in the couple of minutes that follow, and they set up the plot for this really quickly. The reason why this guy is being targeted is because he's the son of the head of the triad. And so the head of the triad, who's been in hiding for some time, he comes in and is like, what's going on here? These guys know that you're the most deadly weapon in Taiwan. Like, why would they come and attack you with just three guys? There must be something else at work here. Okay. And little does he realize that he's fallen for the same trap that his son has. He's come out into the open because a bullet comes through that window, takes out poor old dad. So... the guy, I don't know what the term would be in, within a triad sort of a scenario, but the guy that's kind of like the consigliere for the family, he says to the son, hey, look, there's very few people we can trust here. The only course of action now is for you to go to America, Los Angeles, and talk to your mom. Okay. And we don't quite know exactly what the deal is, but I'm two episodes in. I'm assuming that she's the lineage for this family and that the husband, and we sort of are told this more or less in the second episode, he came and made this triad what it is today. But anyway, it sort of seems as though like her family really are the legacy players in this one.
So this is played very straight face, though. This is a very serious, narrative. This is
for the first two or three minutes. Yeah, first two or three minutes, it's very sort of serious and played completely earnestly. You're watching this as a just pure Hong Kong type thriller from the late 80s, probably the vibe of it. But then once they hit Los Angeles, the comedic elements start coming more at play, and that's where it starts feeling a bit more Jackie Chan. The brother, who's a very serious guy, suddenly becomes a little bit more comedic in his performance as he goes to Los Angeles, meets up with his mother, and then also with his younger brother, who knows nothing about the crime family elements to his family. Instead, he's just a guy who's in his late teens, early 20s. He's starting to become a doctor because that's what his mum wants. Okay, but his real passion is improv comedy, which completely writes him off as a character as far as I'm concerned. But if you're willing to go along with a lead character, if you're willing to go along with a lead character who loves improv, then I guess you can sort of follow this through. But anyway, so this kid, he's certainly soft. He's not really a hard man by any means. And so it's these two mixed match brothers who are now trying to find out what's going on, who's targeting their family and what's happening. So the rest of the show is set very much in Los Angeles, and you really get a lot of, it's a lot of location shooting. So it's a lot of actual LA being seen on screen. Like, they don't go to Vancouver to film this. Like, it is legitimate LA based.
And are we burying the
lead? It's fun. It's a mixed mix of cultures. Well, I'm getting to this, Simon. It's
all right,
Simon.
Okay.
Simon, wait. Very much a mixed match of cultures, and it's all very fun. There's one cast member that I haven't mentioned here, who I feel that you're trying to butt in on. The person playing the mother is one Michelle Yeoh, who has her own experience appearing opposite Jackie Chan. I feel the casting here is one, very on points for the cultural Michelle Yeoh moment that we're all living through, but then also for the style of comedy that Cummings at. Like, you know, there's definitely a lineage here, and she's very much at the center of that also. So you've got Michelle Yeoh, but the thing is, in the first two episodes, she's very much a supporting character, and I suspect that carries through for the entire run. So probably the most exciting known face in this one is, I'm going to say she's backgrounded a fair bit through it. Like, it's really a role that's restricted to one or two phone calls here and there, and like the occasional scene where they meet up with her. It's not quite as prominent as I would have liked. I do know I've only watched the first two and a bit episodes of the program. It could well be that by the end of the season, we see like that one great martial arts sequence with her in the, lead kicking boots. I don't really know if we're going to see that though, but at the moment she's definitely background. And so that's a little bit disappointing, The rest of the show, though, it's actually pretty fun. Like, the actual... A lot of it doesn't hold up to scrutiny. There's a sequence in episode 2, which is a action sequence that involves some men in dinosaur costumes at a kid's party.
Nice.
That's set up as a fun sequence where you can watch a martial arts fight with lots of swinging hands around a place and knives and daggers and gunplay taking place. And that's children. All cool because it's being done with guys. Well, the children are, because it's LA and it's modern day, so all the kids are in the background with headphones on looking at their tablets and stuff. Like, sure. It's a fun throwaway gag. But like the rest of it's people in dinosaur costumes. And so you get that as a gag, but then the actual setup for it doesn't make a lot of sense as to why they even need to get into the dinosaur costumes. It's a bit odd. There's a few things that don't really quite work and are set up purely for the visual gag basis of it. But broadly, it's pretty entertaining. And as long as I don't want to say leave your brain at the door, because it's not quite that. And I hate movies and TV shows where they just say, oh, you know, we do it because it's fun, as opposed to there's actually a reason built into the world of the shows justify it. There's a couple of moments where it stretches that credibility a little too far, but the rest of it is so handsomely put together that I'm willing to look the other way. The one concern I have with it a little bit is when you look at the creative team behind this one. So you've got two people who are the listed credited producers, creators of this one. You've got a guy named Byron Wu, who I actually don't know Byron Wu at all. But the guy that he's partnered up with has a extensive TV, I guess, filmography behind him. It's this guy named Brad Falchuk. People may know him as the recent husband of Gwyneth Paltrow. But in terms of his actual credibility, he's a guy that's been working for years with Ryan Murphy on TV shows that you've seen, like American Horror Story, Glee, Scream Queens, Pose, a lot of the real genre-heavy stuff. But he probably first really made his name for Nip Tuck back in the day.
Sure. No, well, this is something...
Anyway, I never quite finished my thoughts. Watching this from like the surface, it seems very much like it's of Taiwan. It kind of feels as though, yes, there's this Americanized aspect of it, but it kind of feels sort of culturally authentic. But then just the fact that it's Brad Falchuk, he's certainly credible from the Los Angeles side of the story, but you kind of can't help but feel that it's a little bit white people telling the story, even with Byron Wu involved, who I don't know Byron Wu, and he doesn't have much of a filmography behind him to really sort of explain that part of it all. So this is original, I don't know, I could be a bit off base and where I'm coming from.
This
here.
Isn't one of your...
it's all original.
Okay, so it's not one of the graphic novels that like 20 people read and Netflix have got hold of it and turned it into this. It's all original storytelling, which is good.
No, look, more than 20 people usually read these things. 20 people buy it, and then it's like 30 copies that are sent to critics for review.
Fair enough. All right, okay, so The Brother's Son is on Netflix as we head into 2024. That could be a good summer watch. I'm interested by that. And I did enjoy Obliterated, and that was a dumb show, but it was done at such a pace that I got to the end of it without any engagement of my mind whatsoever. Speaking of moving fast, this one has got a few brains. I was going to do a segue there, but that didn't quite work. I went and saw the new Michael Mann film Ferrari in cinemas now.
You get in the wind. Slow. And so?
You're going broke.
How?
You spend more than you make.
So what do I do?
Win the Mille Miglia, Enzo, or you are out of business.
Simon, I'm going to admit, I'm a little bit wary about this one. The last time we saw Adam Driver in Italy, it was, what's the word I'm looking for? Racist. Horribly, horribly racist. There were so many broad Italian accents on display. And so now as I come into Ferrari, I kind of have to wonder, like, how else have these people co-opted my people?
The storyline certainly takes place deep within the Italian countryside at a time when there was a lot of money floating around and most of it was owned by the Ferrari organization. He plays Enzo Ferrari with a larger than life presence, and Adam Driver is good at sort of nailing that. He's very good on screen as Ferrari. The fact he's not Italian, it doesn't play too heavily into it, considering you've also got Penelope Cruz, a Spanish lady, playing his Italian wife. Probably should have fact checked that, but I think that's correct. And you've also got Shailene Woodley in there as his secret love interest. So it's an international production, and Michael Mann has directed that. I think in this day and age, we sort of, if you want to get a big budget film like this made, you've got to go where the bucks are, and the bucks are in casting these sort of people in roles that they may not be otherwise suited for. Having said that, it is also very similar in its structure to that other film from late last year, which caused a bit of a stir for some pretty ripe casting, and that was Napoleon. It's similar in that it's about how a great man is brought to his knees to a certain extent by the women in his life, and how the command and control and the power games they play with each other define them both and help to define their legacy going forward. This is a period in time when Ferrari's organization is struggling to make commercial ends meet. It is being seen as a racing car only organization. It has started to sort of flounder a bit in the placings at some of the big races around the world. So they have to win the next couple of big races to really make a name for themselves, or restore their name, I should say. And at the same time, they are looking at business opportunities to expand the Ferrari brand into more commercial consumer type of car sales. This is a very handsomely made film. Michael Mann's one of my favorite directors, of course. Everybody throws up films like The Insider and Heat and The Keep and all these wonderful movies he's made. This one probably isn't as deep as some of his best films. It's not on a par at all with The Insider, which I still think is Russell Crowe's best performance and what he should have won the Oscar for. But it is he's a director who can create really vivid big screen portrayals, and he has plenty to work with in Ferrari. The sort of denouement of the film is a terrible crash, which almost undid all the goodwill that the Italian people had towards Ferrari, and it is staged in all its graphic detail. It's a very powerful bit of filmmaking, and one that took me and the audience, I saw it with, quite by surprise, because it's quite shocking what a high-speed car crash on an open public road can do to people just watching from the side of the roads. But it's all captured up there on the big screen. So be warned that, in fact, I think the rating for this film is MA because of impactful motor vehicle violence or something like that. It's got that rating to it, so be warned. But in every other regard, this is a very handsomely made and a very watchable piece of big screen biopic.
Yeah, I'm pretty keen to see this one, but I'm also just a bit concerned. It just doesn't seem that exciting, to be completely honest.
It bounces back and forth between. For me, the problem it had was it had the Shailene Woodley character, who's sort of the bit on the side that he's put up in a house and who he's had a kid with, but who he's able to sort of cast aside for a few days when he's got to go back to Penelope Cruz, who does some really big acting in this. Penelope Cruz is very teary and very screamy throughout most of this film, which is great to watch. She can sort of ham it up as well as anybody, and she has a good time doing it in this. And in the middle is Adam Driver trying to sort of balance his life while saving his company, while also dealing with the impact of a government that wants to rule over his Ferrari organization. So this sort of triangle of actors all doing their thing is really interesting. Also in the cast, and it came out of nowhere, Patrick Dempsey in full silver fox hairdo plays this veteran Italian racing car driver. And if you think Adam Driver's Italian accent is pretty rich, wait till you get a load of Patrick Dempsey trying to get his tongue around some of the words. But he's very good in this. All the acting is fine. I kind of enjoyed the film.
Yeah. I don't know. I'll see it at some point, probably. I don't know. I'm excited about the Michael Mann-ness of it, but I'm not sure that the rest of it really holds much appeal.
Cool. Check it out. I don't think Driver got... There was a lot of talk that this was going to be Driver's sort of award season push, but I don't think he or his or the film has been sort of loved too much by the award body. So, yeah, it'll probably disappear from cinemas pretty quick.
Yeah, look, I mean, the awards isn't really what keeps things in cinemas. It's actual ticket sales, and that hasn't been particularly kind to this movie either. But Simon, let us move on. Let us go to a little segment that I've come to love. Let's call it the intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
Simon, as last year was 2023, this means this year is 2024. It goes consecutively. Still getting my head around that. What's interesting at the beginning of every year is the opportunity to look ahead and make some very bold claims as to what's going to come in the year to follow. Now, I was listening to a podcast, the Pivot Podcast. I suspect lots of people listening to this podcast probably listen to that as well, on account of that podcast being very popular. Now, on that one, there was a comment made as they were doing their predictions for 2024. And it was remarked that if you are going to do a list of predictions, never play it safe, never go particularly sort of light on. Instead, take some big, bold swings, because even if you're wrong, it still creates a bit of a conversation and still creates a bit of a sense as to what the world is thinking and what's possible, rather than just necessarily a bold, staid, very easy swing. So as Dan, you and I look at our year ahead. Well, I was going to say, like, even if we're not wrong, like, maybe the things we talk about won't happen this year, but there are things that will certainly happen, or they're certainly related to trends or whatever that we're currently feeling. So, Simon, do you want to kick us off? What is one of, and we're going to do like maybe three each here. Simon, what's one of the things you're expecting from this glorious year ahead of us?
I'm going to focus on the film side of things. I'm going to kick things off with my box office predictions for the year ahead. Not specifically about films, but if we can sort of look into the crystal ball that is the this segment and wonder if the box office can return to those pre-COVID, pre-strike states or dollars that they were once so healthily at. To do this, let's look back briefly at 2023. The US domestic box office just clicked over $9 billion, which is certainly still down on the pre-pandemic levels, which were always coming around the $10 billion or $11 billion mark, but was also only achieved with 124 wide releases. And by wide releases, I mean 1,000 plus screens, not the 150 odd films that you have in those years. But the trends that came out of 2023 were that superhero picks bombed, family films, which used to be out-of-the-gate blockbusters, they opened soft, but then they had legs. You find that foreign films, certainly in the second half of this year, with stuff like Boy and Heron and Godzilla, started earning some big bucks. And for the first time since 2001, which is extraordinary, non-sequel original properties took the top three spots at the box office. So in trying to predict 2024, we're looking at a changing landscape that we're not entirely sure how this is going to play out. There are still going to be a smattering of superhero flicks. We've got Kraven the Hunter. We've got Madam Web. We've got Venom 3. We've got Deadpool 3. We've got the Joker sequel all coming in 2024. We've also got new sort of versions of Ghostbusters and another Paddington and another Planet of the Apes. So there's going to be some familiarity there, but where the billion-dollar Barbenheimer-type films are going to come from is still very much up in the air. So the box office trend, I think, is going to continue positively, but we are going to be faced with a lot less releases, and the international scene isn't providing the cushion that it once did. China is off the market in terms of Hollywood product and getting the Western film sort of over the line in terms of their box office. French box office is surging. It's up 19% this year. German box office is up 24%. Japan is going through the roof. But can we sustain that going forward? I'm going to say yes, but with a very big asterisk, because there's a lot of things changing.
Look, Simon, the one, there's a couple of things I just want to sort of add in there. There's the narrative talking about the fact that the superhero movie's dead. Reality is that things coming from Marvel Studios didn't really perform particularly well, and DC stumbled quite dramatically out there. But you have to look at, you said the top three films weren't superhero films, but number four was. which was Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. So that was a Marvel Studios film. But then that's number one, six on the list of top earners was Spider-Man.
You're going back 22
so,
years.
So, look, I mean, I think
22
it's...
22 years. Yeah, okay. But they're down. Everything's down. In terms of superheroes, everything's down.
Yeah, but Simon, just broadly, just the idea, the overall conceit that the idea of the superhero movie is, you know, on its way out, I don't think it's necessarily true on account of the fact that you do have... like these films appearing in the top 10, if not even in the top four, like, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy is right there at number four. So I don't think the movie's dead, the genre is dead. I think it's more just a matter that there were just some fairly crappy releases from this past year and people could smell that they just weren't really hitting the mark culturally to what people wanted. And quality-wise, I think most of those films weren't very good. I think it's telling that the two films that I actually thought were quite good from the genre are the ones that performed quite well. Across the Spider-Verse was one of my top 10 films of the year, if not maybe top five films. I'd have to confirm my authoritative list. But then also Guardians of the Galaxy 3, I thought was the best of those three movies.
But so, bad Marvel you know, films have made a lot of money previously. Bad Marvel films have made a lot
yeah,
of
I'm
money
not arguing that. Simon,
so the fact
not,
that they...
not arguing that at all. I'm just saying, yeah, Simon, I'm just saying that I think talking about the demise of the genre isn't really quite there when they're still present within a top 10, still making quite a considerable amount of money. What it says to me, and this is, I think, maybe the narrative for the entire year, is that the films that kind of felt they were a bit cookie cutter and had a bit more of a seen it before, been there, done that kind of a vibe, that's what wasn't performing. And those Marvel films, like you look at the one called The Marvels, which felt very much like it was purely from the cookie cutter cutting device implement.
Right,
so like, you know, so that to me and the fact that didn't.
So in predicting 2024.
Okay, well, can I just finish my broader thought? No. So just my broader thought on that one was that the superhero film isn't dead. But interestingly, if you look at the year ahead, Marvel's taking a bit of a break to get their creative back in order. DC's not going to have their sort of next superhero film till 2025. The next Spider-Man, Spider-Verse film's probably delayed until 2025 as well.
Okay,
and
so
you sort of look at it going, well, it's going to be a year that's pretty empty of superhero films.
Exactly. Okay. Craven, Madam
yeah,
Web,
but
Venom
one thing, can I just, okay, I mean, there is obviously still a fair bit there I hadn't really considered, but I was going to say broadly, it sort of speaks to a bit of an issue that you have with the upcoming year, which is some of these big tentpole films aren't coming this year. You're going to find there's just fewer big tentpoles, but fewer films across the board because we had 6 months of strikes. This is the problem that's impacting not just
there,
film,
don't,
but TV
don't go there,
as well.
So, don't go there
there's
too much
a dramatic
lack of, second point.
Yeah. Oh, no, Simon, just the, okay, well, if I can finish my thought here. Okay, just saying that there's going to be a dramatic lack of content across the board. But as we start thinking about the last year of box office versus what we're going to see in 2024, 2023 had a decent volume of content coming through, but there's just going to be a diminishment of content in 2023. You don't have the volume quite there to get it across the line. So
I'll
you can't...
Sorry,
I'm going to take a bit of a line from... Yeah, I'm going to take a bit of a line from something you wrote last couple of weeks saying box office is back. That might have been a vibe that's kind of true, but I think that we're going to start seeing a real punch to the guts to the box office in terms of numbers this year because the volume's not going to be there. And TV-wise as well, like the streamers are facing a real reckoning at the moment. I don't think there's any services that are really seeing a massive decline in numbers, but I feel this year a combination of interest rates and also just lack of content might start seeing a bit more of a ricketing of the TV streaming space as well. So just what you were saying there, I just kind of think you was talking about volume and that's kind of really where I wanted to get to. Volume's going to be down this year. And so it's really going to impact the industry in a way that I don't think is necessarily what anyone's after.
What's your first prediction heading forward?
Sorry, I spoke for a long time then. First prediction, it's probably not really quite a prediction. We were also talking about events and developments that are coming along. Something, just a thing that I think everyone should just kind of keep in mind. The next couple of weeks, if not next month and a half, they haven't quite announced when, Apple's dropping their Vision Pro headset. This is a product that's not going to have a major impact on 2024 by any means, but the release of it at the beginning of 2024 is kind of the beginning of something which is going to be fairly impactful to the TV and film space going forward. This is a device, and I think most people know what the Vision Pro is going to be, but in case you don't, it's a virtual reality headset being produced by Apple. It's going to be hugely expensive, which is why it's not going to have much of an impact this year. But this is the way that these sorts of devices work. One, it's going to come out. It's being sold as a replacement for your laptop rather than necessarily as an entertainment device. So it's being sort of sold very much on productivity rather than entertainment. But as people start gravitating towards that device, they're also going to start thinking, well, what else can I do with this? And this is where Apple TV Plus is going to play a much bigger role than I think people are really thinking about at the moment. There's so many questions like, what's Apple doing in the TV space? Why would they spend all this money? The reason they're spending all that money is because they know as they launch this virtual reality headset and as it starts picking up momentum, people are going to start watching and consuming a lot more media through those headsets. And it is not a coincidence that just on the eve of them launching this headset, they're also dropping that Scorsese film, Flowers of the Killing Moon. Was it Killers of the Flower Moon? Killers of the Flower Moon. Within like what will be probably just a couple of weeks, so that when they've got the ads for their Vision Pro, people can put on, like, you know, they'll be able to show that film, and that'll be one of the big driving features behind this.
Do you envision a world where people are sitting around their lounge rooms with these Vision Pro goggles on, watching Killers of the Flower Moon and discussing the film with the people sitting next to them while they're wearing goggles?
Yes. Okay, so here's where I was trying to get to just a second ago. Here in Australia, we've got this sort of mindset around our entertainment that, and this is very much a 2023-24 sort of consideration of where the world's at. We sort of think about the idea of, you know, you sitting in your lounge room, Simon, with your lovely wife, and the two of you have a headset on, and that kind of feels patently ridiculous. But you also think about the way the world's sort of trending largely. One, in Australia, we are biased because we have generally larger TV sets than a lot of people have around the world sort of en masse. There are a lot of people that live in much sort of smaller confines. And so when you're thinking that you live in a much smaller house or apartment or whatever, the idea that you can strap on a headset and suddenly have access to a very large screen in your home is actually a real appealing selling point to the product from an entertainment standpoint. But again, they're not selling it on entertainment. They're selling it on the productivity possibilities of it. But people will use it for entertainment, and that will be one of the considerations that they make. So you think about that, but you also think about the other big trend that is happening globally. Okay, so this is in Australia, this is in the US, this is through Asian countries, this is through Europe, this is everywhere. You're finding that there's a lot more people in the world who are choosing to live alone. There's a lot of people who are living alone, not necessarily by choice. There's just this increase of people who are doing a lot of solo entertainment consumption. So I think even the question of, would you be sitting there with your loved ones or, you know, your hated ones who also live in your household with you, watching this content together, I don't think there's necessarily all that much of a impediment to the launch, the success of this. I think there's just a lot of people that do solo viewing, and there's no reason why you wouldn't put on this headset rather than just watch your TV on a couch.
Gamers, this is for gamers.
No, it's not. The Vision Pro was actually, well, the Vision Pro was very much set up with like games not really as a priority on it at all. Apple haven't done particularly that strong in terms of launching Apple Arcade being their gaming platform. It may be that a few iterations down the line, gaming becomes part of the focus again. At the moment, as I said, this is being sold very much on productivity. This is being very much sold for your work from home staff who are engaged in Zoom meetings around the place. They're trying to sell it with the idea that people are going to wear this in offices. And I don't entirely buy into that. Like, that kind of feels a little bit clunky. But also, from times where I've worked 9 to 5 in offices, there have been plenty of days where I've literally sat at a desk not talking to a single person on my floor. I walk into the office, I sit in front of the computer, I leave at the end of the day not talking to anyone around me, but sometimes talking to other team members through Zoom and other platforms. So maybe that is a way that people use in offices. I don't entirely want to dismiss that, but one of the additional things will be TV, movie consumption. And if you think about that idea of the technology gap that exists at the moment, where I talk about this all the time, the only thing that's stopping people from watching a lot of movies at home is that they don't have a cinema screen or sound to the level of what you're finding playing in theaters. But that gap is coming to an end very soon. When, why would you go to the movies when you've got an equivalent size screen and sound experience in your own home lounge room? So that's kind of some of the selling points and why people would be watching it on their devices.
If you wear a headset.
And that'll be a deal breaker for some people.
It is going to be such a seismic shift in the way people consume films to suggest they sit there, or TV series to suggest they sit there in their little apartments for 9 or 10 hours while they're binging with a headset on. That is inconceivable in terms. I think this product is an elite product that is only going to be there as a prestige item for the very high end of the marketplace to use in a productivity setting. And I think it is many, many years away from changing the way we watch television or films in our home. It's just my thoughts.
But that can be. I mean, that's exactly how I started. That's exactly how I started this, Simon. Simon, that's exactly how I started this. It's 2024. It's not going to change the world now, but it starts somewhere and it's with this. And yes, it's going to be a big clunky headset to begin with, but in the same way that your mobile phone has gotten thinner and smaller, your laptops, your computers have gone from desk-bound devices to thin MacBook Airs and similar products, you're going to find that these headsets are going to get smaller, more comfortable, and the experience is just going to start getting iteratively better. So it's not going to change the world now, but it starts now. Over the next couple of years, you're really going to see this leap ahead in a really profound way that's going to have an impact that a lot of people aren't quite expecting.
My next prediction for the year coming forward is we touched on it briefly, but is to do with content, and content being the films predominantly the US studios are releasing. Now, doing a bit of research for this, though, only in the last few hours, there are only 107 wide US releases, and that's by wide I mean 1,000 cinemas or more, slated on the calendar for all of 2024. In 2023, there was only one weekend, and that was the weekend that just passed, the New Year's weekend, when there wasn't a major new release in cinemas. In 2024, there are 6 empty weekends where a major new release, a wide new release, isn't locked in. That's scary. Of course it's scary to the exhibition sector, but I can't talk about that sector with any sort of great knowledge or depth based on this. So they're going to have to deal with that lack of content. What we have to look at here is whether the industry can get past this first quarter of 2024 up to the end of April. There are only 31 wide releases on the calendar compared with 44 from 2023. The big money player is Dune Part 2. If that falls shy of $1 billion globally, it'll be very, very hard for the sector to recover in any meaningful way going forward. What we are all waiting to see is where this year's Barbie and Oppenheimer dollars are going to come from. Now, there's a lot of really interesting films into the marketplace. And I've got a list of about 20 here, which I'm not going to run through. Lionsgate are having a great year. They're coming off the Hunger Games prequel, which has done very well for them. There's films like Wolfman. There's films like Red One with Chris Evans and Dwayne Johnson. There's a new Clooney Brad Pitt film. I can't believe I'm saying this, but musicals are kind of back. Both Wonka and The Color Purple have done very well over the December month. So we've got Wicked coming forward, which could be a real player. If Ryan Gosling wins an Oscar for Barbie, his next film is a big budget action comedy called The Fall Guy. And our man, Kevin Costner, has a 2-part Civil War era epic called Horizon coming in the middle of the year, which he has mortgaged his home place for and done put up a lot of the dollars for in the way he did with Dances with Wolves. So there's content here that could break out, but there's going to have to be a whole lot of sort of second and third base type of films that's surprised. There needs to be more Godzilla Minus Ones, which is going to sort of top out at about 70 million in the US, or there needs to be more 80 to $100 million films that surprise by taking that sort of money for this to be a good year for people. I think it'll happen. I don't know how it's going to happen, and I'm keen to see which of these films is the big breakout movie. But the strike / COVID inspired content sort of barren landscape that we now find ourselves in 2024 is going to be so challenging going forward.
Look, I mean, you're right. This is what I was just saying. We're just not going to have the volume there. And there's none of the movie titles coming for definitely the first 6 months of the year that I think are particularly that promising or exciting. Like, there's some possibility that Disney may have a bit of a quiet success with the next Planet of the Apes movie, but looking at the history of the Planet of the Apes movies, like they've been consistently sort of strong enough earners to earn sequels, but they've none of them's really sort of had a massive cultural moment, which upsets me as a huge Planet of the Apes fan. And the last three Planet of the Apes films, I think, have been exceptionally good, but they haven't really quite had that cultural resonance in a way that I certainly would have liked. But also, like, you know, just talking about the thing about, like, Barbieheimer, like, that was a, I think, just one of those sort of weird cultural quirks that comes along. I'd be surprised if anything comes like that along this year. It's just going to be, like, you know, we didn't see one the year beforehand or, like, culturally something that comes out of the gate surprising like that in any other year that I can really think of for years and years. That's just one of those, it just seemed like happy coincidence. It's just kind of like all the stars aligned for it, and it just kind of came about.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. And both the films delivered, which is important. The thing we have in the first half of this year, going from sort of March, April, May, there's a new Ghostbusters, there's a new Paddington. Like you say, there's Planet of the Apes. There's Inside Out 2, which I know Disney are sort of hopeful for. There's some recognisable titles in there. And like I mentioned, June Part 2 has to be the huge hit. Whether they're all going to connect...
But that's the thing, June Part 2, like June Part 1 came out mid-pandemic. A lot of people watched it at home, so they don't really have that cinema connection to the franchise. I think June, because it is quite a bit more cerebral, is a bit of a hard sell for audiences generally. The idea that June Part 2 is going to improve on the, I think it was just under $500 million box office that the first one did, I just don't think it's going to happen. Like, you know, they're going to put their marketing dollars behind it. And if it ekes its way to $500 million, like, awesome, because June Part 1 was really quite good and I'd like to see more success here. But I just don't see it happening.
We'll have to wait and see. I disagree. I think with Chalamet coming off Wonka and Zendaya getting a bigger part in this and playing a bigger part in the marketing, she's also got another film coming out around the same time, Challenges, the sexy tennis drama that she did with Luca Guadagnino. So there's a lot of titles with enough buzz there that if they connect, they can make an impact on the end of year figures. But I can't predict with any great confidence that it's going to be the George Clooney Brad Pitt film Wolves, or it's going to be there's a Greg Berlanti directed movie with Scarlett Johansson and Channing Tatum that coming from Apple Films that has a lot of buzz about it. But is it going to be the $600 million behemoth that Barbie or Oppenheimer was? We don't know. So you don't know. Yeah, I don't know where it's going to come from. The market suggests that it will be there. I just don't know which one it is. So my prediction is I don't know.
The real strike against June Part 2 is the fact that it's got the word Part 2 in the title. There's going to be lots of people who might have gotten along to that if it was, I don't know the name of the June books at all.
But you keep saying it was a blockbuster at home. People are saying that you said that a lot of people watched that at home. And I know a lot of people would have said that I wish I'd seen that on the big screen.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did watch it at home, but I still think that there's quite a gap to the experience of I watched that at home to I'm now going to go and see this in a cinema. Like, they're just two different experiences. I just kind of think it becomes a bit of a barrier. And a lot of those people that watched it at home and enjoyed it that way will just wait the couple of, like, you know, 2 months it usually takes these days for a Warner's title to make its way to streaming. They're just going to wait for it to turn up on Max.
That's the unpredictability of this. I'm more the other way. I think there were enough people that are going to say, oh, man, that would look awesome on the big screen. I'm going to go out and see, especially if it comes at a time when there hasn't been a big event film at the movies for 6 weeks or so. As we're saying, this early part of the year is quiet. So people are going to say, hey, let's make this our first trip to the movies in 6 weeks and make it a big event pick. So, but like I say, this one could go either way.
Really quickly. On New Year's Eve, Simon, I spent my final moments of the year watching Big Trouble in Little Chinatown in my friend's brother's home theater. So he's constructed like a home theater out in his shed. Okay. And it felt like it, you know, going to one of those sort of boutique cinemas. Anyway, we're watching that movie and I just kind of felt myself sitting there and I was thinking about June Part 2 a little bit. And I thought Dave, being the guy that owns like this sort of home theater, is exactly the audience for June Part 2. And June Part 2, if you think about who the audience is for these June movies, as I said, it's cerebral. So it kind of leans itself towards sort of university/college educated men who are a little bit dorky. Okay. And it's those people that have spent money on their home theater systems and everything else. So the idea of them staying at home and waiting a month to be able to watch that is not entirely as much of a reach as if it was like a Fast and Furious movie, for example. There's just kind of, something about the audience, the vibe of that makes me feel that audience is happy to stay at home.
That's what Oppenheimer was. It was the thing with Oppenheimer. Nuclear fission film that people shouldn't have come out of their homes to see, but did.
I actually agree. I don't think, like, from the top level, I don't think that film would have gotten the box office it had if it wasn't for being part of the Barbieheimer phenomenon. I think that just improved the box office quite a fair bit and got a lot more people excited. My big prediction for the year is there's a lot of talk about who's going to buy Paramount Global. Is it going to be private equity? Will it be Warner Brothers Discovery? Is NBC Universal waiting in the wings? I reckon the obvious thing, and I've been saying this for like the last year or so since Warner Brothers and Discovery first merged, is that they are waiting for that next big deal. That next big deal, in my mind, has always made the most sense, being Paramount Global. Yes, it saddles them with a massive amount of debt, but I can't think of any other partnership at this current stage which actually gets Warner Brothers Discovery on the trajectory it wants to be on without that acquisition. I think they're going to make a serious play for it. And if they do make a serious play for it, the ramifications in both US media, but in Australia, is going to be absolutely massive. This is the flow-on effects from it. First of all, the two of them end up merging. So you're going to find, because the future is really about streaming. So you're going to find two of the dominant streamers teaming up with their current subscriber base. There's going to be some double ups there. So you've got to swipe away like at least 45% of their subscriber base because they probably have both platforms. But it means that you're going to have a service which is not quite at the level of a Disney Plus, but certainly close enough to still be considered a player within that space. They'll certainly be dwarfing Peacock from NBCU. So they've certainly got that, but they take their way into being a dominant streamer and stay as part of the conversation. They have a broad range of cable channels then, which is absolutely not the place you want to be at, but it probably gives them enough of a hefty package to be able to sell off like the most lucrative channels around the place. So BET is probably one of the ones that I'm really talking about, but that'll go. But I reckon they can sell off the rest to a private equity firm on the cheap. They're not going to make much money off it, but I think they just need to get it off their books. As I said, they're going to have a massive amount of debt that they're just going to have to start working through. Okay. But where it has ramifications for other industry players, think about here in Australia, we've got at the moment, the Foxtel Group have the HBO contract, okay, and other Warner's titles through that. By them signing up with Paramount, they are likely to merge that into that Warner Brothers HBO deal was never going to get re-signed. It was always going to be them launching a new service in Australia. But it just means that instead of launching Max as like its own standalone thing, it'll probably just take the place of Paramount Plus in Australia. So they already have a subscriber base. They're in a pretty good place to sort of launch that. Merge those titles together. You've got a pretty good streaming service. So like that's going to be fairly monumental to the Australian streaming market. But what I'm really interested in is the ownership of CNN. At the moment, you have this massive digital transformation that company is about to go through. It's going to go from a linear cable service to trying to operate on the same level of something like the New York Times. But where I think they're going to have their point of difference is they're going to keep being very video focused. And so I would expect to see digital products that are very much sort of TikTok-like, but with a news focus. So you're watching people sharing news and stories about the world, but it's going to be journalists sharing that news and information. So when you're after news and information, you're going to be going to a platform that feels familiar, but has that integrity behind it where you know you can mostly believe in what's being reported to you. So a company is going to do it. I feel that CNN's the one that's going to really sort of make the impact there that needs to happen. If that happens, you start seeing reverberations through the rest of the media. So there's very few players that are actually really serious about short form news video in that way. It's been very much about taking traditional news and putting it in a video format for online distribution. If they approach from the other direction and go really, truly digital first, which is the talk that's coming out of CNN right now, I think that if you've got like an actual sort of real serious product on your hands. But if they suddenly take over Paramount Global, what it means is that both in Australia and the UK, they're taking over Channel 10 and Channel 5 respectively. That gives them large-scale news organizations in both countries to have a proper news presence in each country. if they suddenly roll out CNN, which will be very US focused because that's how these things happen, but then suddenly have Australian and UK arms, they suddenly have access to a lot more global news and information coming through with the power of CNN International sort of infused in that as well, which gives them a much stronger European base, gives them a strong Asian base. I would be very concerned if I was the Nine newspaper group, which runs things like Sydney Morning Herald and Brisbane Times and The Age. I'd also be concerned if I was News Limited running news.com, because all these companies are so heavily text-based, give them suddenly a very serious video competitor with a product that people were actually excited by. Like, that becomes a real monster on a global scale. So my thing is that deal, Paramount Global being taken over by Warner Brothers Discovery, has massive reverberations in ways that people aren't thinking about just yet.
I think you've totally tapped the zeitgeist of that sector of the industry, and I can't see anything wrong with that prediction. That's far more than I understand of that part of the industry, and has educated us beautifully. Thank you, Dan Barrett.
A lot has to happen in order for that to play out like that. But yep. I kind of think the tea leaves are there for it.
Yeah, for sure. Here in Australia, the film sector is in just as much turmoil as the rest of the world. Coming in 2024, we've got three sort of name brand sequels that'll drive the local sector's hopes. Force of Nature, The Dry 2 with Eric Banner, the Mad Max saga film Furiosa, and Wolf Creek 3. They're your big three sort of known brand names that are going to take some multiplex space moving forward. There's some original content. There's an adaptation of the short film The Moo Guy, which is like an indigenous themed horror pick, and that'll be looking at hopefully some Babadook size or Talk to Me size box office. There's an animated film called Lesbian Space Princess. I know you'll be watching that, but that doesn't premiere
until November.
That doesn't premiere till November at the Adelaide Film Festival. And a movie called How to Make Gravy, based on the Paul Kelly song. Beyond that, it's a bit of a crapshoot in terms of what is going to fill cinemas with Australian product going forward. The website Screen Hub has listed 33 Australian features as potential releases next year, but very few of them have locked release dates, and many of them are streamer original content productions, which may spend some time in cinemas or may just go straight to the tellies. So once again, we're left with a film sector that is relying on a few films, doesn't have any big commercial prospects other than those regenerated IP works. And I don't know where the Australian film sector is going to be in 12 months, other than continually churning out smaller films that have artistic quality that very few people see. And with the sort of tax breaks that some states are offering overseas productions, I don't know if we're going to have a lot of films coming here to Australia anyway to shoot. So as far as where the Australian future film industry lies, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. That to me sounds like business as usual.
Exactly right.
Look, the last thing I was going to talk about is this year, I think it's going to be a major tipping point for animation from Disney to suddenly show Disney as being less of the powerhouse in the industry, and for Netflix to really take that crown. So the one film I would definitely look at in the schedule ahead is the launch of Spellbound. This is the first Skydance animation film that is properly from John Lasseter, the former Pixar head who joined Skydance a couple of years ago. We have seen one film from Skydance Animation so far, which was Luck, which appeared on Apple TV+. Luck had a first great 3 minutes, and then there was the rest of the movie. The thing that's probably worth keeping in mind with that one was that John Lasseter kind of came in right at the end of that one, whereas he was really there for, I think, all of Spellbound's development from the ground up. So what we're looking at is the voice in American animation from the last 30, 40 years. So John Lasseter is the guy that, as I said, head of Pixar, Toy Story's his, every major Pixar film that followed, either he wrote, directed, or was an executive producer on, head of Pixar, which means that, all of Pixar's success is John Lasseter's success. Oh, of course, with him having been ousted from Pixar based on some wandering hands that got very huggy here and there. Basically, he found a home over at Skydance, and Skydance just recently signed up with Netflix. You've got the combination of strong creative from Skydance. That's making an assumption that he's brought his magic over with him, but, you know, let's assume that he has. But you've got that combined with the network effects of Netflix, where if they've got a piece of content that people genuinely care about, that gets some viewership. What Netflix don't have is the strength of the merchandising arms behind them. They don't have the theme parks. They don't have a lot of other aspects that Disney have. But you need to start somewhere. And if Netflix, which I think have had patchy success with animation up until now, if they actually get a proper monster-sized hit that has some cultural cachet, like that really makes a major difference in terms of the animated features that they're launching from that point going forward. Suddenly Netflix becomes a destination for your big marquee animated films in a way that Disney kind of hasn't been since before the pandemic.
Well, I'm glad you asked. I was down the South Coast for a bit of a holiday, and as is often the case with South Coast holidays, it rained the whole time. I had one good day in the sun, refer to the top of the podcast for the burning of the skin that it provided, but I did also get time to see the last few episodes of some of my favourite series from last year, Monarch, Legacy of Monsters. This is the Apple TV Big Godzilla storyline, wrapped up wonderfully well. It's one of the great last episodes I've seen in the last 12 months. It brought all the elements together of the themes of the series, the character's search for family, the unity that was provided across generations that was handled so perfectly in the series. It was a terrific last episode and a terrific last final few seconds, which introduced a gray-bearded character that is going to play well into the hopefully the next season of Monarch Legacy of Monsters. I also wrapped up A Murder at the End of the World, which we haven't really touched too much on this podcast. This is the Disney Plus / Hulu series made by Britt Marling and her collaborator, whose name you know, but I can't remember, and stars Emma Corrin as the sort of cyber sleuth 20-something who gets taken away to an underground lair in Iceland and murders unfold that she has to help solve. This was a really clever and beautifully made sort of spin on the Agatha Christie style people locked in a single location and trying to solve who's going to be murdered next and who did the murdering, with a lot of ultra up-to-date tech and AI talk involved. So I thought this was a blast. It was a real slow burn show, but one that absolutely established Emma Corrin as a great lead and was a really entertaining show. And finally, the Aussie miniseries Paper Dolls. I think there's one episode to go as we record this, but it's been a guilty pleasure all along. It doesn't deserve to be this good because it's kind of trashy. It's the story of the all-girl band based loosely, she assures us, Belinda Chapel from the Bardot days of the girl group at the turn of the century. Paper Dolls is kind of a take on that. It handles some pretty trashy content in a fairly intelligent and engaging way. Great bunch of young actresses as the group, all of whom sing and dance in a manner that is believable. Some real douchebag guys in it, but that's kind of the record industry as I understand it. Paper Dolls was a real surprise. It's kind of one I couldn't wait to get back to every week.
Yeah, no, I'm good. So, Simon, where I just wanted to plant my flag is that, I don't know, I've talked about this a bunch on a podcast, I'm sure, or maybe you and I just talked about, don't know. I've been rewatching LA Law. I am several seasons in now. I think season 4. Actually, I'm coming up on the end of the season, so season 5 very shortly. What's been interesting about this is thinking about it in a continuity of television. So for years, people sort of bang on about, you know, I mean, I'm guilty of this as well, talking about Saint Elsewhere and Hill Street Blues, sort of leading towards that early 90s sort of renaissance of network dramas. So your Twin Peaks, your NYPD Blues, your ERs, your Homicide, Life on the Streets, and just talking about like that consistent sort of jump from quality to quality. And as you hit the 90s, you just see this sort of impact that a lot of the creators from those early 80s TV shows had on the rest of the industry. So all these great shows we're watching through the 90s going into the 2000s, like they usually had creatives that were working on Hill Street Blues and Saint Elsewhere and other sort of shows of that quality in those early 80s. And so you can see it growing and evolving, and so all of TV sort of swamped through. But I think missing from this conversation broadly is LA Law, which very much feeds straight in. Well, obviously with the Stephen Botchko earnest of it all, goes from Hill Street Blues to LA Law to NYPD Blue. And of course, births David E. Kelly as well as a TV creative. So you've got him obviously going off and doing Picket Fences and Chicago Hope and The Practice and Ally McBeal and Boston Legal and sort of follow that all the way through with some stops at Doogie Howser and that weird show that was like Charlie's Angels, but not. But anyway, we don't really talk about that program anymore. But I just think that LA Law just gets lost in that conversation about great television. And yes, it starts out feeling very 80s and a little bit hokey and a little bit sort of too slow for its own good. But this series of episodes I'm watching at the moment in season 4, you can really feel like the speed of the series picking up quite dramatically. Like there's a lot of character payoffs to what we've been watching for the seasons leading into that. It feels like a show that's really just found its maturity. And when I just think about these great TV shows, I just wonder where LA Law is in that conversation, because it just isn't really part of it. And I just wonder if it's the availability of the show hasn't been there. Like, where could you have watched this? Like, it was barely on DVD. It's never really been streaming anywhere. It's now streaming in the US on Hulu. And I kind of think that the show is maybe about to have a bit of a cultural moment.
Can I just jump in quickly? Because I was there for the LA Law sort of explosion and when it became popular. And it certainly had a credibility issue in the early day. It was seen as a very glitzy, more LA than Law. Like, it was very seen as what Law is like in the high glass towers of downtown Los Angeles. And it was seen as a very glossy sort of tinny kind of sheen to it. But I agree, it seemed to have gotten smarter and became even better television as it went along. So it was kind of like in the shadow of a lot of really serious TV, like the Hill Street Blues and all those sort of things. When LA Law came along, it seemed a kind of like the Baywatch of law shows, but then it got taken a lot more seriously, whether that was through better writing, better directing, more credible acting, or whether we just sort of finally came around to it and went, oh yeah, you know, all along this has been pretty good. So I totally get your point.
Well, what's interesting, you talked about it being the Baywatchification, and it's probably not really quite that. It's probably more the Dallas Santa Barbaraification of a legal drama. Where I'm at in the early 90s, and bear in mind, this sort of predates Melrose Place by a couple of years. So the season I'm watching at the moment is the beginning of 1990. So we've just entered the 90s, and that correlates with the beginning, midway through season 4. And to me, this is where the show has really just sort of found its voice. So we're a year away from Melrose Place, and I guess that park is 2 years away from Melrose Place actually finding its voice. It's very soapy. It's very glitzy. Okay, but they've really managed to lean into the sensationalism of the law. And you can feel that through David E. Kelly's work that sort of follows. Like, he was always a guy that was willing to lean into the sensational. But here it's the sensational and the soapy, and that's really what makes the show sing.
Let's have a look at what this day in history has to offer. January 6, 2016, Dan Barrett, the US domestic box office record of $760.5 million set by your little film Avatar is broken by which film? What film set the
My
new
My little film Avatar.
Your little film
Avatar. Avatar, there's no greater monster of box office success, my friend. Look, if my memory serves, this will be one of the Jurassic World movies. I'm going to say it's the first Jurassic World movie, which I think is titled Jurassic World.
Yeah, no, that's not the answer I've got. It was Star Wars: The Force Awakens.
Oh, what is it?
Yeah, Star Wars.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, that broke the record.
Yeah, that makes sense.
January 8, 1991, comic genius Jonathan Winters and legit nutjob Randy Quaid premiere their sitcom pairing, which would last 29 laugh-filled episodes. What was it called?
Now, I know that Simon Foster wrote this question cackling to himself thinking, Dan's not going to know this one. But what he doesn't realize is that Davis Rules was a mainstay on, I want to say it was the Arena Channel when I first got Foxtel, which is in like about 97, 98. And I watched this sitcom just endlessly. It starred them. It also had Bonnie Hunt in the show as well. But the answer to your question is Davis Rules.
It was created by a guy. It was the first TV sitcom that Danny Jacobson was credited as creator of, and he went on to do Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place, and Mad About You, most famously. He wrote a lot of the episodes of Soap and of Roseanne. And you're right, it had Bonnie Hunt. It also had Giovanna Ribisi, Patricia Clarkson, Deborah Jo Rupp, who would go on to play the mum in That 70s Show. So it had a bit of pedigree to it, but clearly after 29 episodes just didn't click with the audience. So it's called Davis Rules. I don't know if you can see it. I probably should have checked that before I did the podcast. But
Simon, I can assure you, from when it first aired, the only place it was ever seen again was when it landed in Australia like 7 or 8 years later and was just playing on the Arena Channel. That is the only other place this has ever been available.
January 11, 1927, the head of MGM, that Hollywood giant, Louis B. Mayer, announces the creation of what industry body? January 11, 1927.
I'm almost certain this will be, and I don't know if it was called that at the time, but the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
That's exactly what it was called at the time. Yes, January 11, 1927, it was launched. Don't know why, but I should have done research on that as well.
I can tell you why it was launched, and it was an effort to stop people from unionizing.
Unionization, yeah, okay. let's wrap this up with a cracking birthday quiz.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no, not happy birthday.
Dan Barrett, January 7, 1964, won Nicolas Cage. You may have heard of him. January 8, 1935, a young man named Elvis Presley was born. January 9, 1939, a young lass would grow into the beautiful Susanna York. And January 11, 1972, a favourite of yours and mine, Amanda Peet. What could these four disparate and diffuse personalities have in common? It's all to do with a role they've played, a certain type of role.
Okay, look, I mean, part of the issue is that when you do the birthday quiz, you create a little visual graphic you post on Facebook, and you always drop that graphic into the rundown we've got here.
Yes, I do.
And I'm looking at the graphic, and you kind of just tip it away entirely by the fact that they're all there wearing military garb. Yes. So I don't know exactly how specific we're getting in terms of ranks, if that sort of plays into it, but all of them have played, figures within the American military. So obviously Elvis went into the military, GI Blues. So
GI Blues,
I don't know what rank he held there. Amanda Peet, you've got her image from being in The Good Wife. Okay. Where she played a character who, she was in a show for 4 to 5 episodes, and two of those she was in her military garb as a JAG, but then she ends up leaving the military and becomes a regular lawyer, so we see her for a few episodes out of the uniform. Nicolas Cage, you've got here in, what even is that film? I want to say it's Dogs of War, but I don't think that's true. It's something else that my brain's not connecting.
Well, he's
something,
done the
and
rounds.
Susanna York, is that picture something of Valor?
He has done USS Indianapolis. He was in the Navy. He was in Wind Talkers. That picture is from Captain Corelli's Mandolin. He was a US Army Ranger in Con Air. He was an Apache pilot in Firebirds. He played an Italian lieutenant, that's hard to say, in a 1989 film called Time to Kill, and he was a returned Vietnam veteran in Birdie. So he's done the whole, he's run the gamut of military service on screen. And your Susanna York guess?
Yeah. I was going to say also Nicolas Cage, by extension, I believe, was a flying Elvis at some point in the Honeymoon in Vegas film.
Yes. Yes, he was a flying Elvis. He certainly was.
Yeah. Susanna York. See, I don't actually know what the film is. Like, I look at that thinking it could be maybe from the movie MASH, but I don't think she was in that, so I'm not too sure. Yeah. But presumably the thing that links all these together is the played military officers.
Yeah, Susanna York, the beautiful Susanna York, was Section Officer Maggie Harvey in the Battle of Britain. I don't know if the picture I've got in my thing there is from the Battle of Britain, but she was a very memorable British officer in that great film. So that wraps up our first podcast of 2024.
So looking at the Susanna York, I can see her in a background that looks like it's in Southern California, circa Austin Powers. So the area that they're driving through saying, this looks like it's in no way Southern California, is the same area that they shot large portions of MASH, that they shot elements of the Batman TV show, that the Star Trek show, whenever they had
I think it's Africa.
Desert-y planets.
I think She actually did a few sort of military roles, and I think that might be in sort of North Africa or something. So, sure. Yeah, you're right. It does look like. Hey, I'm the movie guy. That's my area of expertise, he said, knowing that you don't know. All right. So, Screen Watching can be found on Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast, on Threads and YouTube at Screen Watching. And you can email us screenwatchingpodcast at gmail.com with all your views on this first Screen Watching episode of 2024.
Yeah, you can find me as a person on Blue Sky or over on Threads at the Dan Barrett. You can also find me each day penning the Always Be Watching newsletter. It's got the big TV, big stories and TV movies and other stuff that streams and is on screens. I should write this down at some point, Simon.
You really should.
I really should. But yeah, find that at alwaysbewatching.com. And just as a bit of a bonus for subscribers to the newsletter, I do a bonus email every Friday afternoon that lists all the new and returning TV shows for that week. So you can program your TV viewing accordingly.
Screen-space.net is where you can read my obituary of the great journo doco maker John Pilger, who passed away in London through the week. He was 84. Bit of a hero of mine in terms of his journalistic work. And it was sad to see him pass away, although he leaves behind an incredible legacy. That's over on screen-space.net.
Folks, thank you very much for listening. If people want to donate some money, I am looking to buy a new bike after mine was stolen, but whatever, that's just on my mind right now. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week with a shorter podcast, we promise.